Half of our panel is here. Please welcome Nicholas McGeegan.
Hello.
Yes. I'm not going to take time to recite Nicholas McGeegan's really splendid, imposing biography. He is such a favorite with us in Aspen. We feel as though we know you very well.
It's wonderful to be here again. But nearly my 20th year, I think.
Fantastic. So because a lot of my questions about your program on Friday night also will involve Robert Levin, I thought I might start with something a little offbeat, which is that you're going to give a master class for singers on Sunday. This will be at 1 p.m. on Sunday out on the Buxbaum Teaching Campus down Castle Creek Road. It is free, tickets are not required, and these classes, the Sunday voice classes, always at 1, every Sunday, are always fantastic, beautiful, interesting classes. But what do you have in mind?
Well, I think it lasts 2 hours, and I've got 3 singers so far, so I'm going to talk a little bit about Baroque opera, first of all, with lots of pictures. I did this a couple of years ago, and I've been asked to repeat it. And then I've got some singers coming actually to sing the stuff. So without their wigs and panier, but nevertheless, that's what we'll do. So it'll be for general audience and for singers audience. So I'll lecture for about 45 minutes, and then we'll hear some nice music, which is why people come here.
Fantastic.
There's no one who does it better.
Oh, no.
Yes, I highly recommend it. And you will have time to go and then to come back for the 4 o'clock concert in the tent. So it makes for a beautiful musical Sunday. We now welcome Robert Levin. And Robert has been a treasured guest in the past, but perhaps not as often as Nick. So I'm just going to mention one or two things about Robert, whose career in music has been so significant and varied. Immediately upon graduating from college, he became head of the theory department at the Curtis Institute of Music. And went on from there. He is a musicologist, a composer, really, a creator of music, I'll put it that way, and a marvelous, marvelous performer. And he then went to the Hochschule für Musik in Freiburg, and from there to Harvard University, where he was professor of music and is now professor emeritus of music, but he has so many specialties. I was recalling, and you can tell me if I'm wrong about this, the first time I had the honor of presenting you in a public setting was at New England Conservatory. I was the provost, you were at Harvard, and it was about Schoenberg, I think.
Yeah, that's right.
So people say, oh, he's the world's greatest expert on, you know, the classical style and Mozart's use of keyboard and et cetera, and that is possibly true. But he has many,
not
many...
Not with Nick on the stage with
no,
him.
No, it is true for him.
Okay. Many, many other fantastic interests. So...
Yes.
Oh, okay. Great.
Great.
Now, I'm going to start with a thought that I have not examined. For instance, I have not done what Robert Spano would have done and gone to the dictionary to look at the etymology of all these words. But one thing is erudition, and certainly both Nick and Robert are remarkably erudite, and I think erudition is often the result of tremendous hard work over a very long period of time. And then another thing is wisdom, which I think of is how do you make erudition work? Because erudition by itself is fine, but there's more to life than that. And then finally, there's inspiration. And because both of these gentlemen, both in their performing work themselves, but especially in their work with young people, bring such a palpable quality of inspiration. So that's not really a question, is it? But would you like to say anything?
Go ahead, Robert. A wise one.
Well, you know, it's something to... realize for me that next year will mark 50 years that I've been teaching, and that's a fair amount of time. When I was 12, I went over to Fontainebleau and studied with Nadia Boulanger,
And I worked with her for five summers and for a whole year when I was 14 or 15, got horribly homesick, almost went home, ended up staying there. And, of course, like almost every other person with whom she came into contact, she changed my life forever. She gave me, as I was fond of saying to people when they said, well, what was her teaching like? What did you learn from her? I said, well, she gave me the keys to the castle. And she gave one a toolkit that had everything in it that you could possibly need, no matter what direction your life might take you. And, for instance, Nick and I will be collaborating with Robert Chen on the Mozart Concerto for Piano and Violin, which he began in 1778 and abandoned when the performance fell through, and which I completed when I was an undergraduate at Harvard. And when I got the idea of completing Mozart, I looked into the toolkit that she gave me, and there were the tools that I needed to do that. And she was much too clever ever to talk to a pupil about what she thought that pupil ought to do. She never would talk about the future in that way. She was extraordinarily demanding. She was deeply affectionate. She was a grandmother and a tyrant rolled into one. And, you know, I had to read full scores of Stravinsky works at sight and get pounded in the ribs by her bony fists if I didn't do it perfectly at the first try. But all of this is just a way of saying that when I was about to graduate from Harvard, I, like everybody else in 1968, faced immediate drafting and work in the jungles of Vietnam, and I assumed that I would be getting an M16 rifle and I would be shot and killed and that would be the end of me. When, about a month before the semester ended, I found a letter in my mailbox at my Harvard dormitory, very fancy stationery, and the handwriting was definitely not American. The return address was 2022 Delancey Place in Philadelphia, and I didn't know anybody who lived there. And I opened up the letter, and the letter was from Rudolf Serkin, who, of course, was a god for me and every pianist of that generation, and every time he gave a recital in Carnegie Hall, my parents and I were there. There was no possibility that he had any idea of my existence, and yet in this letter he asked me if I might be interested in becoming the head of the theory department of the Curtis Institute of Music, which I thought had to be some cruel hoax perpetrated by some of my college classmates, because, you know, the whole idea was totally absurd. But when I called the number in the letter, a Germanic-sounding male voice answered, and I realized, oh, my God, this really is Rudolf Serkin. He said, oh, you got my letter, you know. So I went down to Philadelphia, and I spoke with him for 2 hours about what the education of a young musician in terms of musicianship ought to comprise. And at the end of it, with his eyes twinkling, he looked at me and said, you probably think this is just as crazy as I do, but if I'm to believe Nadia Boulanger, you're the person that I need. Ah! So I accepted. I didn't think about it as anything more than her intervening to save my life from the army. It never occurred to me that there was anything else at stake. Fast forward to 1979, and I get a telegram asking me if I might be available for an important post. She was asking me to go to Fontainebleau and do all of the teaching that she normally would do, because by the time I got there, she was in a coma, and she died some months after that. And I was very daunted by this. It's the greatest teacher of music, I think, in the history of the discipline. And yet her mother was a Russian princess, and she wasn't used to having people say no to her. So I went over there, and I taught all summer, and as I got into the car and drove away from Fontainebleau, I suddenly, the whole thing just became clear to me. Why had she done this? She hadn't done it just to help me in 1968. She had done this because she had taken a look at me, and she had decided that my calling was teaching. And therefore, in her quiet little way, she went about making it happen. And here I am 49 years later. Maybe she wasn't wrong.
Yeah, it turned out okay for you. I think as you say, Boulanger had no template whatsoever for what a student ought to be like or ought to be doing or was everything came from the student instead of from some preconceived idea she had. In this respect, she was very much like Dorothy DeLay, a great teacher who we had with us in Aspen for many years. But every single violinist who came in front of Miss DeLay was a new being for her and would have a different personality, a different road as a musician. I'm going to actually take one moment to tell a funny, sweet Nadia Boulanger's story. This involves a wonderful mutual friend of Robert's and mine and one of my favorite people, Patricia Zander, who went to study with Boulanger when she was 16, and she was a very naive, sort of unprepared English girl, except that she was a remarkable musician. So at her first tea, Mademoiselle gave very famous teas, and you were just as likely to see Cocteau there as to see a 14-year-old student. And so it was her first one, and she was still unsure of her French. And so Boulanger pulls her over and says, "This is the finance minister of France, and we've just been talking about the possibility of a devaluation of the franc. What do you think?" And so Patricia said, I really have no idea. And Boulanger pulled herself up to her not very immense height and said, "Mademoiselle, it is possible to be ignorant, but it is impossible not to have an opinion."
How true.
Yes, I could tell you a couple of stories like that too. But you know, if you look at her and you realize that, you know, apart from Leonard Bernstein, nobody of that generation did not study with her, and Bernstein, of course, revered her. You know, she taught Copland, she taught Sessions, she taught Elliot Carter, she taught Virgil Thompson, all of those people. But she taught Philip Glass, and she taught Keith Jarrett, and she taught Astor Piazzolla, whom she told, "Don't write symphonies, don't write string quartets, that's not what you were born to do, write tangos." And she taught Quincy Jones, and the jazz trumpeter Donald Byrd. And all of those people she guided to become themselves. This is the thing that's so extraordinary about her. She could look at a piece of music you had written, and she'd point to a note and say, "That B flat, are you sure that shouldn't be a B natural?" And you'd look at it and you'd say, "Oh my God." Either it would bring the whole house of cards down, and you would never show her that piece again, and she would never ask about it either. Or it improved it immeasurably, and you learned something from switching one note to another.
So, Nick, you both being such great teachers, do you have a story about a great teaching moment that you experienced as a student?
Oh, I had, well, several. One, I have to say, was not a terribly positive one, but which was that I had an amazingly good and brilliant teacher who shall remain nameless at the University of Cambridge, who was completely wonderful, but he could never understand why anyone got anything wrong, which is actually not a terribly good thing in a teacher, because talking about B-flats, he'd say, "It's a B-flat," and you'd say, "Why is it a B-flat?" "But it's a B-flat. It has to be," without ever explaining why. And he said, because he never ever made a mistake in his entire existence, he couldn't understand why anybody else did. And I found that, luckily I'm not in that league, but it is terribly important to understand why something might not be right. And if you hadn't made any mistakes in your life, you actually can't teach. I went to a wonderful thing at Ravinia a couple of years ago, which was, we did a small opera by Jake Heggie, after which Patti LuPone gave a little speech. She had a nice little thing of champagne on the stage, and people from the North Carolina School for the Arts came and sat in the audience. And she said, "I'm going to give you a speech about failure," which is not what they wanted to hear. I said, "It's the best thing that could ever possibly happen. I left Juilliard, and I've seen my fellow actors, some of whom are still in the same soap opera that they have been in for the last 25 years, and they have never developed as an actor because they've had no bad experiences, nothing where something was a failure. They've landed on the floor, and they have to pick themselves up again and learn from it." And she said, something not going so well is one of the best teaching things that you can have. It forces you to rethink. It forces you to reboot. And I thought that was a wonderful speech to give to young students. The other one I was giving was given by actually a very good teacher. And he said, I'm not trying to teach you anything. If you want to look these facts up, go to the library. I'm trying to teach you how to think. And if you can think, then you can leave this university and learn anything you want. But you just have to have the courage to say, well, now, what would it be? Well, how do I find this out? What doesn't quite jive with this in some way? And I find actually that I'm quite happy on planes now, because so long as there aren't more than three babies behind me, I can actually use the time to think.
Well, let's turn for a period to the program on Friday. I'm just going to tell you what it is, and then I want to jump right to the Mozart violin piano concerto first. But it opens with Overture to Magic Flute. Then there is this concerto, which Robert has already mentioned, a very, very early incomplete work written for violin and piano soloists with a small orchestra. Then there is a different sort of exotic piece, Rondo in D major, which is for piano and orchestra, and we'll talk about what it was for and what it's doing there. And then Schubert's great C major symphony. So going first to the concerto, we've already opened the season with the Mozart G major violin concerto. That was last Friday. And with the piano concerto, so-called Jeune Homme, that was on Sunday. So these are also early works, although Charles Rosenfeld that the Jeune Homme was the sort of first mature great work. But what is it that is interesting to you in this very early period of Mozart's work, and that so interesting that you wished to make the work performable?
Well, I mean, one should start by pointing out that by the time Mozart commenced the composition of this piece, he had already written about 300 pieces. So that's half of his output. So calling it early is true compared with the Magic Flute or the last three symphonies. But Mozart was a completely professional composer by 1778. He had been in Paris. He had written his Paris Symphony there, which is a standard repertoire piece. And, of course, he had been exposed to the Mannheim Orchestra and the musicians in Mannheim, which was one of the most cultivated musical cities in Europe at the time. The orchestra was widely celebrated as being the finest anywhere. And because of royal succession, the elector in Mannheim decamped to Vienna, oh, no, sorry, to Munich, and he took the orchestra with him. And Mozart later encountered the orchestra in the pit when he wrote his great opera, Idomeneo, in Munich. The concertmaster of that orchestra, who was clearly one of the finest violinists in Europe at the time, a man named Ignaz Frenzel, decided not to go to Munich with the orchestra, and he remained in Mannheim, and Mozart and he put together the project of forming a new orchestra and giving a series of concerts there. And he says, they have founded an Académie des Amateurs, as in Paris. Mr. Frenzel directs the violins, and I am writing a concerto for piano and violin at the moment. The manuscript to it is in Paris. I've spent a good deal of time with it. And I became involved with that piece, as I explained to the orchestra this morning, because I had been asked to play the organ in a performance of the Mozart Requiem at Harvard. And in conjunction with that performance, the conductor pointed out that a sketch had been found to a fugue on the subject Amen, which Mozart evidently wished to use to end the lacrimosa of the Requiem, and he died, and so he never got to that point, and Süssmayr was deathly afraid of fugues, and so he shelved it and just had the chorus sing two chords, Amen, which was a simpler way of doing things. And I had actually just been in Nice studying conducting with Hans Swarovski, who told me that if you wanted to play Mozart concertos, well, you should improvise cadenzas, improvise embellishments, play along with the orchestra. And I had never heard anyone do this, And he said, well, you haven't heard Friedrich Gulda, which was true. And he said he had made a recording with Gulda. I should buy it, listen to it, and imitate it. And I bought it, and I was thunderstruck by it. And I thought, I want to learn how to do this. Well, Nadia Boulanger, of course, gave me some tools to help. But I thought, if I were going to improvise, first, before I could improvise in the style of Mozart, I would need to compose in the style of Mozart. So this fellow coming along saying, why don't you finish this fugue, seemed like a kind of an interesting way to get that ball rolling. So I worked on the fugue, finished the fugue, we performed it. And then I decided that I was going to finish my Harvard education by writing an honors thesis. And instead of being in the French department and writing about Charles Baudelaire, why didn't I write about the unfinished pieces of Mozart, about which I knew nothing, except the Requiem. You know, he died so he didn't finish that because he died. But were there any other pieces that he didn't finish, and why wouldn't he have finished them, and so on? And I made the astonishing discovery that there were over 140 pieces that Mozart began and didn't finish. And not the worst ones. I mean, some of them are dry runs, and you realize he says this is going no place. But most of them are not only interesting, some of them are more interesting than the finished pieces. And this was before Alan Tyson, the great British Beethoven and Mozart scholar, made a census of all of the music paper that Mozart used in his entire life, and could therefore date pieces that were undated by comparing them with dated pieces written on that same kind of music paper. And he was able to show that many completed Mozart works were unfinished works on his writing desk for as much as 10 years. That changed completely the whole view of the significance of these fragments. So if you want to know what Mozart would have written if he had lived a few more years, the place to look is those unfinished pieces. And so I thought, I will choose some representative pieces and go to Europe, find the manuscripts, look at the manuscripts, and try to create practical performance editions of these pieces. I was 18, 19 at the time, and it was pretty crazy as an idea. But when you're 18 or 19, you don't think about how crazy these things are. And I went off to Paris to the Bibliothèque Nationale because I found out about this piano and violin concerto. And I also noticed that the Kirchhoff catalog, which lists Mozart pieces but does not discuss their quality, in the case of this piece, Alfred Einstein, the editor of the catalog, wrote, it is one of the greatest losses in all of art that Mozart did not finish this piece. I thought, okay, that's good enough for me. So you look at a piece like this, and it breaks off at a certain point. The first thing you have to figure out is what's there. What percentage of the piece is there? Mozart had a mastery of proportion that surpasses every other composer. His work is highly hierarchical. There's a consistency to the percentage of the piece that the opening orchestral introduction occupies. When a tune comes here, it will come there and there, but not here. And I discovered these things, and it became very interesting, because if I could take that template and then assume that the orchestral introduction contains most of the material that you're going to hear later on in the movement, I could start extrapolating. And that's what I did. I took a clarinet quintet, not the clarinet quintet, but another one from 1791, this concerto and the Requiem fugue, and that was my undergraduate honors thesis. And at the end of my senior year, I wanted to perform these pieces. And I asked a violinist who was in residence at my dormitory, Adam's house, if he would play the violin part of the piano and violin concerto with me in a performance that would unveil these things. And he said, it's much too hard for me, but I know a splendid violinist who could do this very well, and her husband could direct the orchestra because he's a very fine conductor as well as being a composer. And that's how I met Rosemary and John Harbison. And I looked at John Harbison's music at that point, and I thought, this guy's got it. I was 19 years old, but I said, he's going to make it into the Pantheon. It's much more important for me to play his music that everyone will soon play than to write my music, which probably nobody will play. And that's what happened. I gave this thesis concert at Sanders Theater. The place was packed. Michael Steinberg showed up from the Globe, wrote a rave. And then suddenly I had people from the Boston Symphony. Ralph Gomberg calls me up. He says, I hear you're completing Mozart. Is there anything for oboe? I said, yeah, there's an oboe concerto. He says, really? Would you fix that up for me? I said, sure. So So I started doing stuff like that. But this D major concerto, I mean, I think it would be nicer for Nick to talk about it because he's experiencing it, you know, directly and immediately, whereas it's something that occupied me nearly 50 years ago, and I look at it now and I shake my head saying, I don't know how I did that. No idea how I did that, you know. Never mind whether it's any good.
Well, it is very good, and it's it sounds as if it's completely fresh, which is wonderful. And you really can't tell where the Mozart leaves off. It leaves off in bits. It's fully orchestrated at the beginning, but then little bits of the solo part, and then tiny little bits of the first violin part and things exist. So it's not a clean break, as it were. Little bits go on, and you really can't tell where. And it has a cadenza, which Robert's also written. And it's a wonderful, wonderful piece, but with quite a grand orchestra, with trumpets and drums and flutes and oboes, obviously to show off. It has a little whiff of the Sinfonia Concertante about it.
Absolutely.
And it's a wonderful piece, and this will be its first performance in Aspen, I'm quite sure.
For sure. And one of its early performances in America.
And so something to look forward to in this concert. And you're also playing a rondo in the same key, which is
that's convenient.
Which is so that's a bit as an alternative last movement to a concerto.
Right. The first original Mozart concerto is actually the one that's usually called number 5, K175, which he wrote in 1773. And I have the feeling that it was actually intended to be an organ concerto. But we don't have time to discuss that right now. But never mind. Mozart wrote two concertos in which the last movement, like the first, was in what we call sonata form, with the first tune and the second tune and the development and the recap and all of that terminology. And it's interesting that in both cases, he replaced the finales with rondos. He wanted more structural variety. It was very interesting to see what prompts Mozart to abandon movements, and often it's because he feels that they don't go together in an ideal way. And so the other one is the B-flat violin concerto, the number 1, K207, where he replaced the finale with the Rondo Concertante, K269, and then this concerto, 175, where he replaced the finale with the Rondo K382, which he performed in Vienna, and it was a huge success. The audience absolutely loved it. And it's a minimalist piece. I mean, basically, it's actually a set of variations on a tune which uses only two chords, what we call tonics and what we call dominants. And in fact, you could say that the orchestral score contains maybe one of the original viola jokes. You know how musicians are always telling viola jokes? Well, the viola part is only one note, which is repeated over and over again. It's the A on the open string. It goes, ba 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 ba. Ba, 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 ba. That's the first half.
It's a learning on the job experience.
I think I could play it.
Yeah.
But it's very catchy, and there's something very very attractive about it.
It sort of needs the village people behind it sort of doing this.
That's right. Or Busby Berkeley, anyway.
Yes.
Well, let's turn to Schubert. I'd like to ask Nick about the Great C Major Symphony, but this morning in the masterclass that Robert Levin gave, there were so many glimpses at huge insights that there wasn't time to pursue. One that was striking to me was a thrown-off comment about one of Schubert's late piano sonatas and his experiments in the integration of harmony into formal structures. And also some people say that late Schubert is also a prefiguration of minimalism. So more in the textural, I think, expanses. So Nick, tell us just a little about the symphony and about what you're doing with it.
Well, it's called the Great C Major. It could also be called the Long C Major. And I think one of the things that, well, all composers do, I imagine, but one of the things that Schubert was constantly doing was trying to maybe conquer problems. How do you write a very, very long symphony? He'd written a small one, It's called the little C major. But how do you make a grand symphony? He started it probably, I think, in the autumn of 1825. And it went through several things. There's a piano score of it, I believe. And then was finally finished off not long before he died. Although Schubert was capable of writing at white heat. And apparently if he ran out of manuscript paper, he'd just start writing on the tablecloth in the pub. He was constantly inspired, but he did also work at his music. And one of the things Robert's been talking about writing fugues is he actually went for composition lessons very shortly before he died. Although he was always a fantastic composer, he felt he wasn't very good at counterpoint. So he went and actually took lessons in counterpoint, which is remarkable. The result, particularly of that, is the E flat Mass, which is one of my favourite pieces. But so he's having a go at writing a piece on the grand scale. Now, Schubert had, I would say, almost zero possibility of getting a performance of it. This did not necessarily. This was not the most important thing. The important thing was the compositional challenge. He would write operas, even though they had no possibility of performance. In a sense, because he wanted to see what he could do in the Rossini style or whatever. He wrote string quartets, which he probably could get performed. He wrote piano duets, which he certainly could. But these great big symphonies, this big one, was never performed. It was, I think, found in a cupboard 20 years after his death. And I can say that Thursday? So 3 weeks tomorrow, I was actually standing in the room where Schubert died in Vienna. He lived in really not great poverty, but certainly poverty. The room is about 10 feet by 12, and it's part of a four-bedroom apartment. No kitchen, no bathroom. All that's in the corridors outside. Four rooms, and in there lived Schubert, his brother, his brother's wife, and all their children. And I was quite alone in there, and all they have are, there's barely room for a bed. They had copies of the letters that he wrote in that room, saying things like, I don't know if I'll ever see you again. I haven't eaten for 11 days. I'm really enjoying The Last of the Mohicans when I'm not editing the most recent songs that I've written. And it's one of the most poignant places. If you're going to Vienna, it's only open on Wednesdays and Thursdays. And you'll probably be the only person there. It's nowhere near the middle of Vienna. And out of the mind that died in what would be an aspen closet, basically, with a window and two doors, came all this amazing music. And one of the things that Alan has said is that you can hear in this, you can say, ah, yes, he'd obviously, Beethoven's Ninth got that little bit. Beethoven's Seventh had yum, bom, 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 bom. The slow movement is Beethoven's Seventh. And then you're saying, well, this is Bruckner 3. Mahler liked the trumpets going, it's pure Knabenwunderhorn. It's a piece that takes from the great Viennese classics. And let's remember that Schubert was the only one of these composers who actually was Viennese. Haydn was born near there. Beethoven was German, and Mozart came from what I think wasn't even Austria then.
It was Germany.
It was Germany. So Schubert is the only Viennese one. But the influence of this piece, which, as I say, was found in a cupboard 20 years later, is immense on Brahms, Schumann, Mahler particularly. And in Mahler's case, it's the use of what critics, those slightly highfalutin characters, think are tunes that are slightly beneath good people. When the orchestra first got to play this, it was the Leipzig Gewandhaus, wasn't it? They wouldn't play bum 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 ba da bum ba dee do do, and we're not playing that cafe tune. That is beneath us. And people thought the same as some of Mahler's tunes, that it was just too vulgar for words. And yet, you know, this is what we love.
One could also add, I think. I don't know of another composer who is capable of evoking sheer, untrammeled terror the way Schubert can. There are moments of it in most of his late pieces, the G major string quartet, the double cello quintet, the E-flat piano trio, Winterhase, and certain moments in this great C major symphony. There's a moment in the second movement when the whole thing starts to sound like the world is about to end. And it just gets more and more horrific until it just smashes against a wall and you pick yourself up and try to figure out what you're going to do with the rest of your life. Mahler, of course, was fascinated by that and tried to imitate it. But again, there's something so extreme about the way Schubert looks unflinchingly into the abyss, comes back and tells us what he's seen and shatters us forever.
And it's true also, when in the first movement, when the trombones basically start playing Wagner, you suddenly get bum ba ba bum, bum ba ba bum, and it's like the waking of Fafner. No one had used trombones like that. And it's, you're suddenly, I have no idea what Wagner knew of Schubert's music, and of course, even if he did, would he admit it? But there are bits in there, because it's a tradition, of course, that comes from Haydn, of being able to take a mustard seed of music and turn it into a forest. The tiniest, even two notes, can be made, not spun out, because he just has so many ideas. And they keep coming and they keep coming, but he's always got control of it. And it's quite remarkable. Some of the terror, of course, is conducting it, let it be said, because it has repeats. It does go on for quite a long time. We will not be taking every single repeat in it, even though it would do the young ones good. I mean, you know, we know for a 6 o'clock concert that, of course, they're all going to bed at 8:30. But I have done it with all the repeats. It was with an orchestra I never went back to.
Well, you know, I've performed the E-flat trio, and the E-flat trio is a piece that Schubert cut drastically in finale. He made three cuts in it, and there's a story that Yasha Heifetz never played the piece because he kept on trying to find a cut in the last movement, not being aware that there were already three of them that had been made. He got rid of 55 bars in one spot and 50 in another, and he deleted the exposition repeat, which is very, very interesting because it reveals something, which is that at Schubert's time, repeats were considered commands, not options, because otherwise there would be no reason for him to delete the repeat, because people would take it or not as they wished. But that piece takes almost an hour to play, and Joseph Silverstein, the great, great concertmaster of the Boston Symphony and conductor in Utah and so on, once told me that when a friend of his was preparing the E-flat trio and one of the members of the trio suggested that the uncut version be done, he said, "I am willing to accede to that request under the condition that I am allowed to address the audience before the performance and say, ladies and gentlemen, you are about to hear a performance of the uncut version of the Schubert E-flat trio. Now, in the course of the performance, should you have the need to get out and get some air, or smoke a cigarette, or visit the facilities, do not hesitate to do so, because I can quite assure you that when you come back, we shall still be playing."
Well, I once studied the B-flat, late B-flat sonata of Schubert with Robert Helps, who you will have known. And he said the following sort of strange thing. He said, whenever I go to a performance of this, or especially a piano jury, I bring a gun, because depending on my mood, if the player does not take the repeat in the first movement, I will shoot him. But on other days, if he does, I will.
Nice one. I think we should mention just very quickly, because the theme is enchantment.
Yes.
And, of course, Schubert is full of enchantment, but we open with the magic flute, which in French is la flûte enchantée, the enchanted flute. Yes. So we actually get your enchantment right there, which is a fine thing to have put in there. And that, of course, is one of Mozart's very last pieces. In that amazing year when he wrote incredibly large amount of music, including two operas, and seemingly unstoppable until he finally hit the buffers at the end of the year. And it's an amazing overture, beginning with the Masonic calls. I'm not giving any secrets away because I don't know anything about masonry, but the thing that they do things in threes. So it's in E flat major, which has three flats, and at the beginning there are three chords. So that's a hint to those in the know. I promise I'll have my both legs of my trousers pulled down when I conduct it, though.
And we do have at the end of the season Clemenza di Tito, which was one of those final operas.
Absolutely.
We have just a few minutes, and I wonder if you have questions or comments right down here, and the mic will come to you.
Yes, thank you. Both Mozart and Schubert died at such young ages. Is it known what they died of?
Schubert did have venereal disease, but whether that actually killed him. The apartment where he died had only just been finished a few months before. Apparently all the plaster was weeping still, and he certainly seems to have developed typhus. So I think it's probably, you might say, this is not being frivolous, but what didn't kill him?
You know, the same thing could be said for Beethoven, you know, where three fatal diseases were battling to see which one was going to carry him off first. With Mozart, the more recent diagnoses have concentrated on rheumatic fever, which were the consequences of his having contracted scarlet fever when he was a child, which nearly killed him and apparently weakened his heart to a great degree. When you consider, again, the sheer amount of music that he and Schubert turned out, you know, if you open up the complete works of Mozart, the 120-plus volumes of his music comprise 23,000 pages. And you try to think about copying 23,000 pages in a creative lifespan of 30 years, and then imagining actually conceiving it. One of the things when Maestro McGeegan commented about the piano and violin concerto with little bits of this and that, one of the fascinating things about Mozart's compositional habits can be shown by examining the tints of ink in the manuscripts. And I don't mean blue and red and green. I mean you went to the chemist who mixed the ink for you, and depending on the biological substances at hand, the color of the ink could be jet black or gray or brown or green-brown or yellow-brown and so on. And as you look at the manuscripts, you see on each page layers running from one end of the piece to the other, showing that what he did was he wrote the principal voices from beginning to end, and then came back and did the secondary voices, and then filled in with the trumpets and drums, and then sometimes there was a cleanup and revision. And the remarkable thing is that when he gets to the third phase, he doesn't have to cross things out that were in the oboe but now need to be in the clarinet or and so on, which shows that he's got the whole piece in his head. But he writes in a schematic way with the first violins and the bass all the way through, and then if there's a solo voice or a solo instrument, he goes to that and then back to the first violin and the bass. So the train of thought is fixed on paper for as much of the piece as possible. So if he gets interrupted, he will have more information about what he had in mind when he comes back to it. Whereas if he had written every instrument of the orchestra bar by bar and were interrupted, he might only have a page and a half and would be saying, "Dear God, what the devil was I going to do there?" And this is a very unusual kind of thing. Not very many composers operate this way.
Well, is it true that he was writing three piano concertos at once in that way?
Well, yes. When I went to Krakow to look at some of the Mozart concertos, 12 of them are in the Jagiellonian Library in Krakow in Poland, I discovered that the three subscription concertos of 1782-83, K4, 13, 14, and 15, all had the same four tints of ink. And considering the fact that each concerto has three movements, that means that Mozart was composing nine movements of music simultaneously. This is not the same thing as painting nine paintings simultaneously, where you can see the entirety of the composition of the canvas. I mean, to be carrying the strategy and the ideas, and it's just stupefying.
I think here.
Just while the mic comes out, I should just point out about dying and things, that I have a Baroque concert as well, and we have two people in that concert. One is Henry Purcell, who died about the same age as Mozart, and the other was Leclerc, who was one of the only very few composers actually to have been
murdered.
For a bit of hanky-panky.
So, in fact, I didn't mention the Baroque concert only because it's virtually sold out. So if you don't have a ticket, get over to the box office right away.
Or join us on stage, perhaps.
So a little preface to my question. I don't know how many of you on stage or in the audience know that the Swiss have done an original thing by creating a museum of failure. And my question is in this regard, in terms of composition or in terms of conducting, where does failure enter the question? Enter the conversation, indeed.
Failing at conducting, well, the piece could break down after bar one. Usually, the orchestra doesn't let that happen. They just carry on and ignore you. It must be said. I'm not sure. Artistic failure would be if I. Well, it's never happened to me to have no ideas about a piece. If I didn't know how to put them across, I would regard that as a failure. And then I have to sit there and say, well, or even worse, that I thought it was great until I heard it. yes, toss that one. But the great thing is, of course, in performance, that you can always change your mind. CDs are another matter. I sort of wish that one copy would survive in the Library of Congress and all the others would self-destruct after 20 years, along with the photograph in the front of you looking like somebody else with hair. I think how it relates, it's similar to playing, I imagine.
The danger, of course, is being too literal about this and assuming that if you played one wrong note, or for that matter 47 of them, that meant that the performance was a failure. On the other hand, people used to say that Arthur Schnabel's wrong notes were more beautiful than the right notes of other people. So, I mean, the question really has to do with fervor and communication, fascinating an audience, drawing them in to the discourse. And I think that will admit a fair amount of uncouth moments, which audiences are apt to forgive, even if one is disconsolate oneself. But in terms of a work of art being a failure, well, I mean, there are plenty of mediocre pieces, and even great composers sometimes, you know, Homer nods. I mean, somebody, when Beethoven wrote Wellington's Victory, which in this country would be said to feature the bear that went over the mountain.
Right.
A great fan of Beethoven's wrote a review saying, should one not, the more that one reveres Beethoven's genius, more fervently wish that he had not written this work, which was an extremely charitable pan. But what Beethoven responded to that review cannot be uttered in mixed company.
There is, by the way, a wonderful British book called The Book of Heroic Failures. My favorite thing in it, I think, is the Korean performance of the movie of The Sound of Music, which they thought wouldn't succeed. So they cut out all the music, and it was a huge success.
Okay, we'll take...
Well, you can read The Great Operatic Disasters, too. There.
And I'm in it.
Are you really?
I'm actually in it.
Oh, my.
We have one question here, I think.
Well, you were talking about the ink with Mozart. Well, most of these composers up to that, through that point, including, I guess, Beethoven, were working with quill pens, right?
Exactly.
That would sound so challenging. Now, by Schubert's time, was he still using a quill or a...
Yes,
so
yeah.
Metal pens
steel nibs came later.
Yeah. So the point is that, of course, you have a pen knife to sharpen the quill, and you want to find the left wing of a goose. Because if you are right-handed, because if you have the right wing of a goose, it will go up your nose.
I assume if you're left-handed, then you would use the
You
right
get
wing.
The cheaper ones, yes. The right wings are cheaper. Because you want to have the pen go that way, not that way. Otherwise, you'll be sneezing all over your music.
Okay, so on that...
Only Nick knows things like this.
On that really exceptionally useful note...
Yes.
We will conclude the concert. Robert Levin, Nicholas McGeegan, Robert Chen joins them in the Aspen Chamber Symphony at 6 p.m., Friday, July 7th. And I also just want to say hello to our audience on Aspen Public Radio. So thank you very much.
Thank you.
Yay. Thank you.